Welcome to another episode of the Deborah Health Report, where we dive into current health and medical topics to keep the Delaware Valley informed and updated. The conversation continues with Deborah cardiologist Sheena Rastogi, MD, about heart disease prevention, resources to understand cardiovascular events, and ways to manage your risk factors. Here's Rasa Kay.
Hi, I'm Rasa Kay. We continue our conversation with Deborah cardiologist Dr. Sheena Rastogi on cardiovascular disease prevention and treatment. There are some new medications she's really pleased with and new approaches with established therapies. It's data-based advice, which Dr. Rastogi warns can get mixed up with less useful content online.
I think getting your information off social media is not a bad thing. You just have to be judicious about where on social media you're getting your information from. If you are going on the internet to Deborah's website, for example, we have a lot of patient resources and a lot of patient information that can help you make good decisions about your health. There are other resources out there as well, like the American Heart Association or the Cleveland Clinic. These are credible institutions that basically put out patient information that is evidence-based. So if you use your critical thinking skills and you are able to discern what is credible and what's not credible, social media can be actually a very powerful tool to help guide your medical decision making for yourself.
Now, in terms of preventing heart disease, beyond what we can do for ourselves, are there procedures, programs that you would recommend to certain patients to prevent a bigger problem as opposed to waiting for it to become more dramatic or treatable?
Yeah.
I mean, how? Because boy, there's so much technology out there, and there's
Definitely.
So much information. And every time you turn to online news, there's another research study about something. So how do you sort through that?
I always emphasize this to my patients that it's always important to stand on the side of offense, prevention, rather than playing defense, you know, after a major event has happened. So I think one of the things that you can do is definitely, first and foremostly, if you have any of the five cardiovascular risk factors, diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, cigarette smoking, or family history of heart disease, the best thing you can do is approach a cardiologist. First of all, they can help you get those conditions under control so that you can stave off any kind of future cardiovascular event. And secondly, they can decide on whether or not you're somebody who would benefit from some kind of imaging test to help diagnose cardiovascular disease. So you don't necessarily have to be symptomatic to see a cardiologist. Just seeking tips and tricks on how to manage your risk factors and how to go about your lifestyle and what medications can you take to make sure that you don't develop heart disease or stroke in the future, your cardiologist can most certainly help you with those things.
Define family history. How close a relationship are we talking about?
Well, certainly first degree relatives. So mom, dad, siblings, your own children. If any of those individuals have been afflicted by cardiovascular disease or stroke, then you are also at risk. Specifically, we talk about premature coronary artery disease. So when your parent, for example, developed some kind of heart condition, maybe they had a heart attack or they had heart failure much earlier in life, that is even more of a risk factor for you as far as a genetic predisposition is concerned. So that's what we mean when we say family history of heart disease. Another less commonly spoken about heart condition is sudden cardiac death. You see this in athletes where, you know, they're really exerting themselves on the game field and then suddenly they collapse and their heart is no longer beating. Sometimes that happens as a result of some kind of genetic predisposition. There are syndromes out there where there are irregularities in the way that the electricity in your heart is getting conducted such that you can develop a malignant arrhythmia, which is basically a life-threatening irregular heart rhythm that can cause you to have this sudden cardiac death. So that's also something to be mindful of. If this has happened in your family, definitely mention it to your doctor because then they can kind of look at you from a different lens and decide, are you somebody that, you know, we should be concerned about too?
What keeps somebody out of your office, somebody who should go see a cardiologist, why would they not come see you if they've got any of these five risk factors, besides just, man, no news is good news?
You know, your heart is such an important organ. If your heart gets sick, then it could really result in a lot of compromise in the quality of your life. And I think people don't like to necessarily face that head on. But I would say you want to be on the offensive side. You don't want to be playing defense because that's worse. And those conversations are a lot harder. But if you're coming on in and I'm telling you, hey, your blood pressure is uncontrolled, we need to get that under control, that is a lot better of a conversation to have than, hey, you have heart failure, we need to talk about transplant.
Okay, so the numbers then that you're going to find out about from your cardiologist, what are the numbers that people need to know to monitor their health and to understand about what might be going on with their prevention efforts?
Parameters-wise, we're talking about blood pressure, heart rate, for example, blood sugar, things like that, cholesterol. They're moving targets. That's because everybody is different, and those numbers, those goals that we'd like to reach for any given individual is influenced by many different things. But generally speaking, to answer your question, a blood pressure of below 120 over 80 is ideal. A heart rate between 60 and 100 is considered to be normal. Blood sugar between 70 and 99, that is considered to be normal. And a cholesterol, a total cholesterol below 200, triglycerides below 150, and an LDL, which is the bad cholesterol, below 100. Those are the targets for cholesterol.
What is VLDL?
VLDL is a type of bad cholesterol. It's in reference to the size of the cholesterol particle. And those tend to be more atherogenic, meaning they have a higher potential of developing plaque than even the regular bad cholesterol that we talk about. So measuring VLDL levels is also very, very helpful.
But if you looked at your chart and you saw an LDL number and a VLDL number, is the VLDL part of the LDL number or that's in addition?
It's a part of the LDL number. Again, your goals as far as your LDL concern, those are moving targets. It really is individualized to each and every patient. If you're somebody who doesn't have any risk factors and you're a completely healthy individual and you're young, and if your LDL is below 100, then you're good to go. But if you're somebody who has a history of heart attack or stroke, or if you have a condition called peripheral arterial disease, which is basically blockages in the arteries in your legs or higher, then your LDL goals are a lot stricter because we're in the business of making sure that whatever has happened to you doesn't progress. So it is a conversation that you have to have with your cardiologist, and the approach is also very, very individualized.
So are there new understandings about these numbers? I mean, I know we adjusted the blood pressure numbers.
So the story there is 130 over 80 is the goal blood pressure for someone who has a diagnosis of high blood pressure. That goal has also been a moving target. It's a very controversial subject matter. There have been a lot of trials and a lot of conversations on the academic level surrounding what goals we should maintain for patients. Before 130 over 80, it was 140 over 90, and we were quite liberal about it. But then we realized in trials that we did that when we are stricter about our blood pressure goals, there are better outcomes. And so, you know, 130 over 80 is still a number that we use, and it's for people who have pre-existing hypertension. But if you're looking for an ideal number and you don't have any other conditions, if you're below 120 over 80, you're good to go.
Anything that correlates to heart rate?
Between 60 and 100 is a normal heart rate, and that is an academic definition. So anything below 60 is what we call bradycardia, and anything above 100 is tachycardia. A lot of people ask this question, hey, like my heart rate is in the 90s, is that a concern? I would say still have that conversation with your cardiologist, but rest assured it's probably okay. You know, as long as you're between 60 and 100 and you're not experiencing any symptoms, like you're not having any lightheadedness or dizziness and you haven't fainted, you're not feeling like you're going to faint, any kind of shortness of breath, like barring that, if you're completely asymptomatic, a higher heart rate that's still between 60 and 100, it's not going to cause you any kind of harm. It might be an indicator of your overall physical condition. You know, when you exercise more, your heart rate does tend to get slower. It's just one of the ways that your body kind of gets conditioned from exercise, which is why athletes tend to have slower heart rates. So in that regard, it can be a number to think about. As long as your heart rate is below 100 and above 60, technically, from a cardiovascular perspective, you're normal.
New treatments for heart disease?
Yes, yes, there have been quite a few developments, I think, in the last 5 to 10 years. One of the most important developments is the development of this medication called PCSK9 inhibitors. These are medications that are directed to the management of cholesterol. They are a second-line treatment after statins. Statin is the first-line treatment, obviously, after lifestyle modifications. And it's basically an injectable drug you inject yourself every 2 weeks. And it is very, very efficacious. It's a very good drug. It can reduce your LDL up to 70%. And we've had great success with the PCSK9 inhibitors. Whether or not you're somebody who would benefit from it is, again, an individualized discussion. But it is something that we've found to be very, very useful in managing very uncontrolled high cholesterol. If you're on a statin medication and your cholesterol is still not at the goal that your cardiologist has decided for you, then we would turn to the injectable medication and you would take that on top of the statin. Many times people do experience what we call statin intolerance. It only happens in about 15 to 20% of people, but it can be pretty debilitating when it does happen. And it's usually to the end of feeling muscle aches and fatigue and brain fog, any combination of those symptoms. If you have statin intolerance and you know you've tried a few different strategies with your cardiologist, which may include reducing the dose of the statin or trying a different type of statin or maybe spacing out the frequency with which you're taking your statin instead of every day, maybe every other day. If any of those strategies isn't necessarily working for you, then the next step, a good alternative would be a PCSK9 inhibitor.
Are there side effects to those?
I would say sight pain probably is the most prominent side effect of a PCSK9 inhibitor. It's fairly well-tolerated medication, generally speaking, which is why it's so useful. You know, a lot of patients do derive a lot of benefit from it. But there are drugs out there that have been used traditionally for diabetes that recently we've discovered is actually also really helpful for heart failure. These are called the SGLT2 inhibitors, and these basically work at the level of the kidneys. They help excrete sodium and glucose in the urine. So when this happens, it brings down your blood sugar, which is helpful for the diabetes aspect, and it also helps with reduction of fluid in the body. So if you're somebody who has heart failure, that can be actually a very desirable thing. So very recently, we have changed our strategy in managing heart failure. It's considered to be one of the four pillars of heart failure management. Now, before we had three drugs, now we have four. The SGLT2 inhibitors is the fourth medication that we try to introduce into a heart failure regimen. So that is a new development. SGLT2 inhibitors can be used in patients who have all kinds of heart failure, and you don't necessarily have to have diabetes in order to take it. And there have been significant benefits. It helps with blood pressure. It helps with heart failure. It helps with diabetes. It's a very good discovery that we've made, I think, recently. But people in the general public who don't necessarily have a background in medicine, right? They think that medications have a certain course, like antibiotics. There's a limit. You know, you take it for a week or you take it for 2 weeks and then it's done. With cardiology medications, it's not necessarily the case. It's not necessarily a course. Sometimes you're taking medications for the rest of your life. And I know that sounds daunting, but one way of sort of reframing that is it's lifelong protection. This is what I tell my patients. If I'm telling you aspirin is something you'd benefit from long term, it's because I want to protect you for the rest of your days. And that's the same story with a statin. If you're started on a medication and you're feeling better, which is the point of the medication, continue to take it because you'll continue to feel better. If you stop, you know, the fear is you're going to roll backwards, you know, your symptoms are going to reoccur. And there are situations where, like for heart failure, for example, if you have withdrawal of, you know, certain important medications, you're not taking them for a long period of time, that could definitely put a wrench in the management of your heart failure. Whereas if you were consistent with your medications and you kept up with your appointments and you asked questions of your cardiologist, right, and you empowered yourself and really took care of yourself, there's a good chance that your heart failure could recover. So yeah, it's very, very important to keep up with the meds, keep up with your cardiologist, and take charge of your health.
It seems like these weight loss drugs are becoming the panacea for everything. Now, is that just because when you lose excess weight, other things just get better in your system?
Absolutely.
It's just healthy to lose the weight. So is that what's going on? Or are these really some kind of miracle drug with all of these things that they can fix and we didn't know?
Yeah, no. I definitely agree that, you know, when you have a good amount of weight loss, that definitely helps with controlling all of the other risk factors for heart disease. You know, when you lose weight, your chances of having diabetes, or if you have diabetes, the chances that that diabetes gets addressed and you no longer have it, you know, that chance increases. You know, your blood pressure gets better. You know, your cholesterol gets better. So all of those things are very, very important. And I think semaglutide is an injectable that's been greatly talked about, I think, particularly on social media. And a lot of people are really vying for this drug because it's such an easy way of losing weight. I would say it's helpful. It's definitely something that we've started to use in our armamentarium for treating cardiovascular conditions. Before, we used to recommend patients with a certain BMI and certain other comorbid conditions to go for bariatric surgery. But you know, recently, since now the indications for these injectables has expanded, being able to offer these to patients for weight loss so that they can reduce their risk of cardiovascular disease has definitely been very, very helpful.
Are there cardiac issues that you're seeing more of or less of over time? Whether we're getting better at preventing them, that our awareness is higher?
I would say we're probably getting better at picking up disease. So if you see prevalence of something going up, it's because we are developing more accurate assessment tools to pick that up from the community. So I would say, A, we are getting better at diagnosis, and B, we are getting better at treatment. So there have been a lot of strides, for example, in the management of coronary artery disease over the past several decades. Back in the day, we didn't even have stents. We had blood thinners. We're talking like 1980s, you know, long time ago. So we've come a very, very long way. And I think the sort of intersection between technology and medicine, that's how we're able to kind of move forward. And I think the treatment of these very prevalent conditions, heart failure is another example. You know, there's this device that we use. It's a left ventricular assist device, an LVAD. It can act as a bridge to transplant if you're somebody who is on the transplant list, but, you know, you're still experiencing symptoms of severe heart failure. The LVAD could definitely help. But if you're somebody who doesn't necessarily qualify for transplant for whatever reason, LVAD can be used as destination therapy. Again, it's very individualized. You'd have to talk to a heart failure specialist to decide whether or not it's the right thing for you. But yes, that's true. You know, LVAD is destination therapy. It can be.
Anything down the pike besides the pharmaceuticals that has you kind of jazzed?
One thing that's sort of in the pipeline is the expansion of the use of TAVR. So TAVR refers to a minimally invasive procedure where a prosthesis is basically placed at the aortic valve position. There's this condition, it's very common, it's called severe aortic stenosis. And that's where you have a narrowing of the aortic valve such that blood is not able to cross efficiently through and get to the rest of the systemic circulation. And patients can get very symptomatic from that. Some common symptoms are shortness of breath, chest pain, fainting. TAVR is a really, really good solution to that. And up until recently, TAVR was reserved for patients who were not necessarily surgical candidates, the best surgical candidates, whether it was because of their age, their frailty, or their other comorbid conditions that sort of prohibited them from going to surgery. So TAVR was very useful in those patients. But recently, as we've started to get more and more data under our belt, we've come to the conclusion that we can sort of expand indications for TAVR and offer it to more and more people, younger people who might not necessarily have very severe aortic stenosis. Maybe they have what we call moderate grade stenosis. The data is still pending on that, but DeBoer is actually currently participating in a trial where we are offering TAVR to patients who have moderate degree aortic stenosis. And the intention there is to see what are the outcomes in patients who don't necessarily have severe aortic stenosis, they have incipient severe aortic stenosis, do they benefit from TAVR? It's developing news. It's developing news.
That's DeBoer cardiologist Dr. Sheena Rastogi. We'll have another deep dive into a health topic that might be affecting you or someone you care about in our next podcast, which, as always, will be available the first Wednesday of the month. I'm Rasa Kay.
You can always listen to all of the informative DeBoer Doctor interviews at DeBoerHealthReport.com. Schedule an appointment at DemandDeBoer.org.